Wing Commander Gil, Reel 2. Can you tell me about Wingate himself, what kind of a person he was?
Wingate was a strange man. He had a temper, but when talking to him was extremely charming, rather shy, small man. I liked him a lot. He was a brilliant tactician, but he wasn't everybody's cup of tea. He didn't get on too well with even Lord Lew Mountbatten, of course, and others, because he was very outspoken and determined in what he thought was right and proper. He was very strict with his troops, but they would follow him anywhere. They respected him as a leader and as a fighter and as a soldier.
In what way was he strange?
Well, there was the story, of course, of how he used to walk around with an alarm clock dangling from his belt and ticking away to remind people that time was passing and time wasn't to be wasted. I remember flying with him Christmas morning. We visited his column, one of his columns, during the training period at Gwalior. And he was greeted by the column commander. But instead of replying, "Happy Christmas," he said, "I thought I gave instructions that no camp was to be sighted within 2 miles of water. You will up sticks now and move." And Christmas morning, whilst Christmas lunch was being prepared, the whole camp had to be moved to a site 2 miles of water. And that was an example of how strict he was. But of course it saved lives, because the Japanese needed to find water for their mules and to drink, and therefore it was one of his rules that no Chindit would ever camp within water, within 2 miles of water.
How did people react to the instruction?
I suppose as any British soldier does, grumbled, but did it, perhaps unwillingly.
Did you see this alarm clock?
Yes, and he would, I think, argue with you, probably really to lead one on to prove his point, which is a method, I suppose, of convincing himself that what you're trying to say is true or not true. We had many arguments over this, problems of how we were going to find his targets and bomb them, but I won in the end, and he agreed, and it was very successful.
You mean he played the devil's advocate, did he?
I think so, in many cases, yes.
Did you see any instances of his temper?
He could get pretty cross, but not in my presence.
Did you see anything directly about his relationship with Mountbatten?
No, not personally.
What made you think that his relations were strained with him?
Well, stories and written since, of course, that he was a bit of a problem to the hierarchy, but was determined and usually got his way.
You said that he was small, but can you say anything else about his appearance?
Small. When I first met him, of course, he was unbearded, but he later grew a beard in Burma, which he kept and still had it when he was killed. After the training days, I saw little of him because, of course, we were operating from Cumbergram, and he, of course, was flown into Burma.
Was he smart?
Smart in appearance?
Yes.
Not particularly. Not during battle conditions, but I mean, I suppose on occasions when one had to dress up. We had a good uniform, but I mean, in battle garb, he was fairly bedraggled.
Was he a scruffy man?
No, I don't think so. He was probably neat and tidy in his manner and his appearance, but I think we all looked a bit scruffy in those days.
Did you notice anything about his eating habits?
Oh, perfectly normal. And yes, we remember eating a goose together one day when which had been shot. And I think we both enjoyed that.
So he didn't have any
no
strange eating habits?
No, none. No. Not to my knowledge.
Now, can you tell me about the long-range penetration group and what its role was supposed to be?
Well, the theory, the practice, of course, had been tried out in Palestine by Wingate when he led troops behind the Arab lines. And he maintained that if he could get behind the Japanese lines and cause diversions and break, rupture their communications, he could do a lot of good to further the war effort. And this was eventually agreed by Churchill as Prime Minister and supported by the Americans. And in fact, Wingate had direct access to the Prime Minister at all times, once it's been agreed. He was supported by the Americans, American transports, and the American combat force was prepared. He was flown in by glider, towed in by American and British Dakotas. And they flew, of course, way behind the Japanese lines. The Japanese were forward between Wingate's columns and the 14th Army. And a lot of damage was done to the Japanese. Whether or not it affected the war effort to a great extent has always been argued, but there's no doubt that it caused disruption amongst the Japanese, and they had to divert forces to seek out Wingate's columns, who were scattered way behind their own lines.
And the role of your unit was to support the long-range penetration group?
That's the idea, that if they found targets, bearing in mind they only had limited ammunition with them, and 2-inch, I don't know if they had any 3-inch mortars, whereas in fact, of course, we had a big punch we could deliver with 12 aircraft, which we normally operated, each carrying 1,500 pounds of bombs and a very accurate delivery, one could guarantee to destroy any target they could pinpoint for us.
Were all 12 aircraft Voltaires?
Yes, we had an establishment of 16 aircraft. Normally two were being serviced or in reserve, and we normally flew 12 on every mission. Occasionally, on some of the smaller targets, such as a bridge, we would perhaps fly only 3 or 6 aircraft.
Over what period were you doing this work?
We operated from operated from February until the July 1944.
And were flying conditions exactly the same as in Burma and Malaya? In Malaya and Sumatra?
No, quite different, because before the monsoons broke, the weather over Burma, of course, was excellent. Good visibility, early morning mist in the valleys. And often, of course, we were airborne before dawn and dropping our first bombs before 7 o'clock in the morning. And occasionally we would be doing 2, if not 3, missions a day. But once the monsoons came in May, then the conditions altered considerably. Very heavy cloud, big storms, cumulus clouds way up to way above our ceiling. Up to 20,000-30,000 feet. And we had big problems, in fact, in finding the target. It was at this time that we were allocated a Spitfire, because instead of flying 12 aircraft deep into Burma and then not being able to find the target because of cloud cover, the Air Officer Commanding, who was Air Marshal Vincent allowed me to use a Spitfire 5, and this I flew with my flight commander on alternate occasions into the target area to signal back whether or not the weather was suitable for the squadron to take off and bomb the target. Thereby we saved a lot of petrol and a lot of engine hours. It was on one of these occasions that I saw two aircraft flying in the Kabul Valley, which I thought were Hurricanes, until I realized they were very slender aircraft with a small canopy and blunt wingtips. And in fact, they turned out to be two aircraft. I immediately disappeared into cloud, bearing in mind I was a bomber pilot, not a fighter pilot, basically. And as I then realized that I might well fly into the cloud, fly into the mountain, and I came out of the cloud, and there in front of me was one of the enemy aircraft, which I took my courage in both hands and flew towards it. My shells, cannon shells, 20mm cannon shells, were moving away from the target because I wasn't near enough. So I tried again and managed to hit the aircraft, which rolled onto its back and went vertically down into and crashed, which was later confirmed as a kill. And it, during these difficult conditions, during the bad weather, often we would have to fly much lower under the cloud to find the targets, and we thereby devised a shallow attack dive, which we hadn't done before, where we would attack the target at probably at about 45, 50 degrees, using long delay bombs, perhaps 6 or 11 second fused bombs. Otherwise, we would have blown ourselves up if the bombs had exploded instantaneously. So by dropping delayed bombs, we were able to clear the target before the bombs exploded. And this proved very successful. We were able to hit several targets and destroy bridges using this type of tactics.
When you shot down the Japanese fighter, did you see the other one?
No, I never saw him again. He seemed to have disappeared into cloud, and it was very cloudy conditions, and presumably he had either lost the other chap. But no, fortunately I didn't see him again, or he me.
Was that the only time you came across Japanese fighters?
Saw fighters. There were 36 in the vicinity on one target we were attacking, but we managed to dive and escape them. On no occasion were we ever actually attacked by Japanese fighters. It was during this bad monsoon weather that 6 of the aircraft were inverted in cloud, unfortunately missed each other. And when they came to, one gunner was half out of the aircraft. He was strapped in with his monkey chain, as we called it, which was a wire cable attached to the floor of the aircraft. Fortunately, he'd clipped his parachute onto his chest. Being a gunner, he wore a chest parachute. He was able to release himself by reaching down and fell away from the aircraft. And he found he was below cloud, between two ridges, and his parachute opened just before he hit the ground. He landed in bamboo thickets and managed to cut himself loose. He then followed a path and was picked up by Naga headhunters, who fortunately were friendly, and in fact one of them spoke a little English. And they took him eventually to a village where a Miss Bauer had been operating behind the lines, sending back messages to the British by radio of the Jap movements. And she was probably part of the Y service, which operated in the jungles in those days, sending back movements, Japanese movements, for intelligence purposes. The name of the gunner was Gabrielson, and he was in the Australian Air Force, a very tall chap. Henriette, thanks to Miss Bauer and a British lieutenant who was leading some Indian Army pioneer soldiers, he was able to get back behind British lines and rejoin the squadron 6 days later, none the worse for his experience.
How much effect do you think that HFR Squadron was able to have during this period? Do you think its effect was very decisive?
Oh, I think the if it hadn't been for the airdropping of ammunition and supplies and food, petrol, cigarettes to the troops, and the support they received from the Hurricanes, the Harry bombers and the Spitfires and Vengeance aircraft, the Japanese wouldn't have been so defeated so decisively. There's no doubt that the Vengeance was a very successful weapon in those sort of conditions.
Did you say Harry bomber?
Yes, it's a converted word from Hurricane, and it was spelt H-U-R-R-I hyphen bomber. A Harry bomber, it was a bomber, it was a fighter converted to carry, I believe, two 250s or two 500-pound bombs under the wings.
What were conditions like, living conditions like for you back at base?
Conditions weren't good. The climate, of course, was difficult. One got used to the wet, humid conditions. Food was a problem. We were always short of food. We lived on dehydrated potatoes and dehydrated meat, often down to quarter rations. I think occasionally we had a chicken, if we were lucky. I think the only fresh vegetable was pumpkin, if one likes pumpkin. And otherwise it was tin food and normal army rations in wartime.
What happened to you after this period?
The squadron was withdrawn after the monsoons back to India for a rest and to re-equip. The squadron went back to Quetta, and there the squadron was re-equipped with the Mosquito Fighter Bomber 6, which is another story, because the Mosquito had a big problem due to the fact that the wings were made of wood. Some of the wings were faulty. There was insufficient glue in the laminated wooden spar, and in the heat and monsoon conditions, the wet humidity, the wings just didn't stand up to the conditions, and if one applied any G, the wings just fell off, and several people were killed in those early days. Geoffrey de Havilland flew out to India to look at the problem. The aircraft were grounded, and it was some time before the Mosquitoes were brought into service. In the meantime, I'd left the squadron after over 3 years with one squadron, which I think must be a record in wartime, and I went all the way back to Burma on my flat feet to become an airplan staff officer at the combined headquarters of 14th Army and 2-1 Group, RAF, under General Slim and Air Marshal Vincent, Stanley Vincent.
What did your work as staff officer consist of?
Planning the move forward of the Army and the Air Forces into Burma as the Japanese were routed and as the British forces advanced down through Burma to Mandalay and on to Rangoon.
What were your main problems at that time?
Main problems, I think, probably were weather conditions, food, again, shortage of food, and all the problems of supplying the British forces in the jungle with all that they needed to fight the war.
Can I ask you a general question about your attitude towards the Japanese enemy? What was it?
The Japanese were feared, undoubtedly, by the British soldier in the early days of the war. He was considered to be a superman. And it was only when Lord Lew Mountbatten and General Slim convinced the British soldier that he was as good as the Japanese, and when we started to succeed against the Japanese, which of course was in North Burma when the Japanese first made their determined effort to capture Imphal and Manipur, that the Japanese suffered their first real setback of the war. Up to that time, he was considered to be a superman, and it was only after defeating him and proving that he wasn't Superman that the morale of the British troops became paramount.
Did you see any instances of low morale?
Not in Burma. In Malaya, certainly, morale was at rock bottom in Singapore. The one occasion I flew there after a night raid. Little was done to combat the fear of the Japanese. Officers and men would disappear during the day when the regular raids took place. Bomber raids by the Japanese would disappear into the rubber plantations. And I think one of the problems of losing Singapore was loss of morale.
Was the morale of the RAF at all affected?
I suppose those in Singapore, yes. I think that the RAF there and the RAAF, because they had so few aircraft, inferior aircraft to the Japanese, we had very few Hurricanes. The Brewster Buffalo, which was the only fighter they had, was very inferior to the Japanese aircraft. We lost a whole squadron of wildebeest aircraft because they weren't escorted by the Hurricanes that failed to turn up on time. The whole squadron disappeared, was shot down, and that must have affected morale.
Coming back to the attitude towards the Japanese, did people hate the Japanese or not?
I think at the time, yes, the Japanese was regarded as not fighting fairly. I think it was considered that we always played cricket when we fought a war up to those times, and some of the atrocities carried out by the Japanese at that time were resented by the British forces.
In what way were they not thought to play fair?
I think by their torture and their methods of ill-treatment of prisoners. On one occasion, one of my gunners, the aircraft, the Vengeance, was filled full of fumes. The gunner, thinking the aircraft was on fire, bailed out without instructions from the pilot. And he landed in Burma safely, was captured by the Japanese. They assumed he was a spy. They tortured him. And eventually he was killed by the Japanese. All the chap had done was fall out of an airplane, inadvertently due to misunderstanding. But the Japanese, I think, at that time were known to be pretty ruthless little men, and it didn't go down well, I think, with the British forces.
Did you get that information about his maltreatment during the war or afterwards?
Subsequently, yes. During the war, we had word back that he'd been captured and taken prisoner and tortured and murdered.
How did you get such information?
It came back through as we overran Burma, as we went down through Burma, and one made inquiries, and the head men of villages would pass on information about the Japanese and their methods. And we learnt that Jack Ellis, his name, Sergeant, had been captured by the Japanese.
Did you have any information about the general treatment of British POWs, for example, on the railway?
Well, out of the 605 of 84 that went out to the Far East, as I mentioned, 12 got to Australia, 132 got back to India, where the squadron was reformed. Now, the rest were either killed or taken prisoner, and a lot of those ended up on the Burma Railway and in prison war camps. At least 50% of those died of malnutrition and disease. And those that came back, their stories were pretty horrible of the treatment they received.
But were you getting information about conditions on the railway actually during the war?
No, not until after the war.
You've talked about Wingate. Did you have close contact with any other famous person?
Well, I knew all the corps commanders, General Schoons and Stopford. General Slim I knew well, of course, being on his staff. Air Marshal Vincent was a, a good friend.
Can you give any details about Slim that you remember?
Oh, a rugged, down-to-earth soldier who spoke his mind and knew what he wanted, and a very determined man, great leader, great fighter, ideal army commander in wartime and under those sort of conditions in Burma.
Was he liked by the men and the other officers?
Oh, very much so, yes. Adored by them. They would follow him anywhere.
Did you ever come into close contact with Mountbatten himself?
Yes, he visited us a couple of times. And he wrote to me say that the squadron had been selected, not to be re-equipped with Mosquitoes, but to instead to go forward and train with Wingate and support Wingate in Burma. And I met him subsequently during the campaign and, of course, after the war.
I think you can illustrate the accuracy with which the Vengeance could be operated as a dive bomber.
By virtue of the fact that it dived vertically and one was able to release the bombs directly onto the target, the army became very confident of the accuracy of this aircraft and the delivery of the weapons, that there were many occasions when in fact we were asked to bomb within 100 yards of our own troops, which worried me considerably, because had there been any undershooting, the bombs dropped short, they would have landed amongst our own troops. So on those occasions, we, having learnt from aerial photographs where our own troops were, we used to bomb parallel to them, so that because there was no lateral error, any error that might have been would have been a bomb that came off late. And so we were able to bomb bunker positions and troop positions at Kohima and other places in North Burma during this battle, which with a considerable accuracy.
Were there ever any accidents?
No, to my knowledge, that we never bombed any of our own troops or missed the target. I think troops were more likely to be hit by supplies being dropped from the Dakotas. And in fact, I think one of the jokes was there's nothing worse than being killed by a bag of fruit.